My name is Tara Conley. I'm the social media manager at Race Forward, the Center for Racial Justice and Innovation, also the publisher of Color Lines. I'm very excited to be here with all of you. Facebook, Twitter, video, and podcasting have all been around for a while now, and yet all of a sudden, they're being wielded as the grassroots level with amazing results. In today's panel discussion, we'll be talking about the ways in which video, podcasts, social media, mobile technology are being employed to address human rights issues on the national and global scale. So our panelists today, I'm going to start off with Susan Simpson, attorney and producer of the hit podcast Undisclosed, The State versus Adnan Syed. Jackie Zamudo, senior engagement coordinator at Witness. Carmen Perez, executive director of Justice League New York City, NYC. Brandon Blackburn Dwyer, managing editor for Global Citizen. So I thank you all for joining us today. I want to start off with the first question. What role has social media played in the wake of international global tragedies as it has been useful, helpful, or problematic as it concerns our collective understanding of these very difficult issues?
All right, I'll jump in. Social media, on one hand, has been a cesspool. It has been the proving ground for extremists. It has been the proving ground for bullying. It has been an avenue for the fringe to find other people that used to be on the fringe. And what we've seen over the last couple of years, and I think you can find some very specific examples in the Paris attack situation, is that it's also been the response to those. It's also been the format that has brought together people of disparate voices to shout down the voices of extremism. So if you look at the Paris attacks, initially, social media played a very functional role. For one thing, it functional even before the attacks. Arguably, you could say, I mean, I don't have this data on this attack, but other attacks, the people that have been behind them have often used social media to organize. So in that sense, they use them in a very functional way to coordinate their attacks, not necessarily the bombing itself, but finding like-minded people. ISIS has been recruiting through those. But then you look at during the attacks, and social media was used by news outlets and by citizens to have the Open Door campaign in France. People were giving shelter to random strangers, quite literally. Literally, the hashtag was Open Door in French. On their way home, it was trying to tell people where safe places were. It was trying to connect people. So it's a very functional role. But afterwards, you saw the echo chamber that is social media, both in a very positive way and in a very horrible way. Immediately, people were blaming refugees, and immediately people were shouting that that's not appropriate. And what I would say was sort of the epitome of the positives of social media response and connecting voices disparately across the world in a very positive light was the Not In My Name campaign. You saw Muslims from around the world step up and say, not in my name, not activities that ISIS are endorsing are in my name, that is jihadism in an extremist way, that is not being Muslim. And I think that campaign, that identity activity, was very powerful, and it allowed mainstream media to react to that and allowed mainstream media to not just point at the example of those that were victim and not just point at the example of those that were the attackers, but to point at regular citizens around the world saying, this affected us and we need to move forward from a political sense. So it does a lot of different things. Mostly, I would say it amplifies what would happen anyway. And it, for both good and bad, brings it from your living room, from your street corner, to a global stage.
Carmen, I'm interested to hear your thoughts, given the organization that you represent here. A lot of folks from your organization have been on the ground, but they've also been on social media doing this kind of work. What are your thoughts?
I certainly feel that social media has allowed us to amplify our voices and also tell our story outside of what's portrayed in the media. I think oftentimes the media will often tell a story that isn't necessarily the truth. And I think with activists on the ground documenting a lot of what's happening, we're able to also build solidarity internationally. We saw that with Ferguson and Palestinians. But I think for us, if you look at who's on Twitter, who's on Facebook, it's a lot of millennials, right? They're not necessarily reading the traditional newspaper in the morning like some of maybe our parents. But for us, it's a way in which we connect a little deeper and we're able to tell a story and actually claim our own narrative.
And I also like to get Susan into this conversation. What are your thoughts about where we are in this particular moment with international global crisis? What role does social media play in that?
I'm always fascinated to see the immediate practical effects of it. Like with this attack, I remember on Twitter, right after France announced that they were closing the borders, someone was going on and filming them crossing the border saying, hey, look, it's not actually closed. Mm-hmm. And you're like, well, that's probably not something we want to be sharing all over the internet. And worse yet, people reporting on the police movements, which I think this time around, unfortunately, we had another, people were better about it. They weren't reporting what the police were doing. They weren't filming as it was happening. And in previous attacks, that's been used by the terrorists to track in real time. And then there's things like Facebook, which apparently now has a feature for like checking in if you're, yeah, I had no idea that was a thing, and I had no idea I had friends in Paris, and suddenly they were checking in. I'm like, well, I'm glad you're okay. I didn't know you were there. So the practical effects are interesting, and they're both potentially harmful, and also great for just letting people know instantly that people are alive, which can help shut down the network so everyone's not, you know, overloading it with calls to one another.
Thank you. Jackie, what do you think about this?
Yeah, I mean, I think the panelists have covered it pretty well, but I think one of the things that we're looking at a lot is kind of how video specifically is being circulated and how oftentimes that can add to the confusion, as it can also add to the sense of community and sense of collective healing. But when there are people who are circulating videos or images to kind of stoke the either excitement or the horror, it can be very challenging and very confusing and also add to the trauma. And we see a number of cases, I don't recall any specifically with this attack, but with other ones where people have circulated images or video from previous incidents and saying, oh, this beheading just happened here when it actually happened several years ago. So I think that can be a really big issue, and I think there's a sense of immediacy that both traditional media and more citizen journalists feel in terms of getting the news out. And so oftentimes they overlook some of the really important steps in verifying the media content that's coming across us so quickly. So definitely one of the things we're working on at Witness is taking some precautions and how we can create media that's easier to verify and ensure that both journalists and citizens who are sharing content are doing so in a responsible and ethical way.
Mm-hmm. And that also brings me to another question, sort of this relationship between citizen journalism and mainstream media. A recent edition of the Washington Post looked at the reason why protesters at the University of Missouri campus might not want media around. The article by Terrell Jermaine Starr examines the legitimate gripes the Black community has with mainstream media, which I think are also fair. Can each of you share your thoughts on how sort of indie or community-oriented media can complement, influence, or maybe avoid some of those mistakes that mainstream media that we see in mainstream media? Carmen, I'll start with you.
You know, it kind of, that reminds me of the way in which Black people, particularly in police brutality cases, are portrayed. And I think, you know, right now what's happening with the universities, at the university at Yale and Mizzou is, you know, I think, again, is taking back your own narrative and telling your own story. Like, you know, we're constantly have, it, there's what's called character assassination. With particularly Michael Brown, Eric Garner, all these individuals who have been killed at the hands of police. But for us, in the work that we do at Justice League, I think, you know, trying not to re-traumatize and share those videos, but actually provide solutions is really key for us, and hold press conferences. But I think we also need the mainstream media to work with us and to share the right information, because we can't just speaking to each other, we can't continue to speak to each other in isolation. But I know that a lot of the folks that are covering in community are actually really wanting to tell a different story about that community. And if it's not being done by mainstream media, then they're going to take it upon themselves to do that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Brandon, what are you thinking in terms of that relationship between mainstream media and sort of that citizen journalism genre?
I'm going to run the risk of being a bit more controversial.
Go right ahead.
Because I think that I agree with everything that Carmen's saying, and I think that it's incredibly important that citizen journalists, particularly in this day and age where there is just so many things happening and local stories become global stories so quickly that there's no step in between. You know, it used to be, in theory, the way it worked, not saying that all stories were brilliant 20 years ago, but, you know, you used to have local journalists that kind of knew what was going on. And then if that story got picked up by the AP, they picked up the copy from the local journalist. And mm-hmm. then it went from the local paper to the regional paper to, you know, the regional TV channel. From the regional TV channel, they did a story with some local context on it that then got pushed national. Right now, we have a local story that goes from a local tweet to CNN in Zimbabwe, and there's no context whatsoever. So that speed has, I think, removed even some of the beneficial checks and balances that mainstream media used to rely on. And so now you have global media reacting in real time to local events with zero connection to real events. So citizen journalism must step into that void. But this is the part that I'll be more controversial on. And it's not an answer I have, so I want to pitch it as a question. Where does the line get drawn between citizen journalists or community-led journalists and fringe journalism? And by that, we used to define a community by regionality. And now with digital connection, we define community by a certain identity or a certain belief structure or a certain viewpoint. And when you have a certain viewpoint defining the way that somebody is giving journalism and speaking to an echo chamber within that community, you run a real risk of getting away from spreading the truth and focusing more on spreading an ideology. And that cuts all ways. That cuts to the people that are behind the Paris attacks, and that cuts to what we would probably, I think, in this room, it looks like a pretty liberal room, to say that, you know, pushing back in the Ferguson incidents and things like that and getting the truth out, it can work incredibly well and incredibly positively, but it's also on that fine line that we have to worry about as we embrace that. Where does it go?
That is an interesting perspective.
Sorry.
No, I'm as you're speaking and as you're talking, I'm thinking about the conundrum in journalism, this idea of objectivity and what is truth. To quote Stephen Colbert, truthiness. You know? and I think we're living in a time where we really have to deal with those very important questions. Jackie, I want to get your thoughts on this question too, especially given what you do with Witness and where are you on this spectrum of citizen journalism?
Well, I mean, it's definitely something we believe very strongly in, but because Witness is a human rights organization and not necessarily a journalistic media outlet, we're very much following the principle of do no harm. And so when we're training our partners or providing training resources, we're always encouraging people to do no harm. And sometimes that even means don't get the story if it puts somebody at risk of either re-victimization or being targeted within their community. So I think some of the ways that we try to educate people around this is ensuring that they understand what informed consent and are seeking that from it, and understand what informed consent is and are seeking that from subjects, and also not just the yes, I consent to being a part of this interview, but that they fully understand what the interview is about, where it's going to be used, and how it's going to be used. I think that's a really important aspect of it. I also think that just providing some general guidance around how to use citizen journalism for journalists is really important. So it's not just, oh, I see a tweet of somebody who's at the scene and they have this really graphic picture and I'm going to share it because it's going to draw the most attention to my media outlet. I think this can be really damaging, A, for the media outlet, because there's always the chance that that image is not accurate, and it can also be damaging for the person who captured that media, the eyewitness, because it can expose their identity. And there's still this sense of, that people have that, oh, I captured something really dramatic or really awful, I need to put it online right now. And we're seeing that start to backfire. There's a lot of research about eyewitnesses who have captured media, posted it on their Facebook page, and then instantly become a target both by the social media communities, but also by police or authorities. Mm-hmm. And this can be really dangerous. It's something we saw even with Ramzi Orta, who captured the video of Eric Garner, and he's since been persecuted by the Staten Island police and NYPD, and it's had a very damaging effect on his life. So we're trying to encourage people to share stories in a way that's safe and comfortable. And one other point that kind of brings it back to the initial question about citizen journalism is I think it's really key that people are telling their own stories and that it's not like a big media outlet or even a small media outlet with the best of intentions coming in and saying, we're here to tell your story. It's the people who are most directly impacted who should be speaking.
Thank you. And that also takes me to, is a wonderful segue. Susan, your work is essentially storytelling in this kind of innovative, different kind of way. I'm interested to hear what you have to say about this connection, this relationship between storytelling and citizen journalism in your own work.
I have no idea where Undisclosed falls on the journalism scale. I don't feel like a journalist. I'm not a journalist. I'm an attorney. Mm-hmm. I feel like an attorney who's doing a podcast about it. But I guess we're somewhere on that scale. It's a story in the news, and we're bringing it out. So I don't know what the relationship is. I don't know. It's kind of, I guess, a new thing, because to me, it's just doing what I do on a usual case. It's just, it's no different for me from my normal work, other than that everyone else is following along and listening as well, which does bring a new dimension. And I guess we're kind of seeing where it's going to go.
And so for projects in specifically involving legal cases and individual defendants, the tension between social media initiatives and legal strategies, social media can be hugely important for defendants trying to prove his wrongful conviction. But in doing so, something like Serial can also seriously derail the appeals and post-conviction proceedings. And so I'm wondering, this is a question for everyone, but especially Susan, as you were talking through, can social media affect outcomes of high profile cases? And if so, in what ways?
Absolutely. It's hard to say what level it's affecting on. I mean, you don't want to, I'd like to think that the judiciary is not going to be affected by a podcast. I'm probably being overly naive about that. But it is affecting everyone else involved for sure. It's involving how the prosecutors respond. It's involving how the defense responds. It's involving, probably most importantly, how witnesses come out and their awareness of the case. I think Richard Glossop is probably a really good example of this, because there, directly, you have a witness who was important and part of Glossop's appeal at the last minute to spare his life. And one of the accusers in that case had a cellmate with him, and he was out of prison now, and he was watching Dr. Phil. And Glossop's case come up, and he's like, well, I know the guy involved. I knew the guy who testified against him, and I knew he was lying. I would not be okay with myself if I didn't go forward and tell his attorneys this. So without social media, without the profile that case had, those witnesses would never be found.
Carmen, I want to direct that question to you as well. And we were also talking about the Eric Garner case and sort of the legal implications of that. How have you seen social media, if at all, affect sort of the outcomes of some of these protest narratives that we're seeing?
So just before we go there, I just kind of also wanted to touch back on, you know, the traditional journalism versus the citizen journalism. And, you know, I think we do harm when we identify those that are on Twitter and have a huge following and actually tell the story as if we identify them as activists, right? I think what's different, and I only say that because a lot of us have been on the ground for quite some time. And so, you know, to your point around, you know, being careful, there are some kind of like things that need, there are processes that you have to go through. You know, we never called a person who was out documenting a story an activist the way in which, you know, Oprah and several folks have identified several people in the civil rights movement just based on the fact that they are telling a story of what's happening in real time. So I just kind of wanted to say that, particularly because I know there's kind of like a struggle between the movement at this moment of who is actually doing the work and then who's actually getting the recognition for it. But in regards to your question, I think what's, you know, what was mentioned earlier about Ramsey Orta, I think one of the things that we have seen in the police brutality world is the fact that those that are documenting the stories and bringing light to the brutality are actually being targeted by police. But a lot of the work that we do inside prisons with individuals that are going through a trial or are going through the process of the system don't necessarily have access to social media. So, you know, I think it's something that's also of privilege, right? The communities that we serve in the Bronx, those kids aren't necessarily tweeting. They don't know who the person on Twitter is. You know, we went to a conference and we were working with some high school students, and for me, it's more the millennial folks. But I think in regards to, like, cases, just with the population that we serve, there really hasn't been any type of, regardless, you know, whether it's the larger cases or not. But for us, with the people we work, it's not detrimental. But I will say there's a lot of trolling that happens on social media. For those of us that are out on the streets, we do get death threats. That happened immediately after the two officers that were killed. It was around the Eric Garner protest. And a lot of us, because we were out at the forefront, were getting death threats. There was a lot of new hashtags that were Blue Lives Matter, things like that. And so I think trolling happens as well. And we don't have that protection. We're just people that are out on the streets, outraged, wanting to do something and to actually bring justice to the lives that are being lost. So for us, it's like wanting to understand, where do we actually protect ourselves, and how are we protected by this type of trolling on social media?
Thank you. And you reminded me, too, that there was sort of a convergence of narratives during that time. I'm actually doing my dissertation on young people and connection in social media, and one of my sites is right where the two police officers in New York City were shot and killed. And the person who shot and killed the two police officers who came, I believe, from Baltimore, I forgot what his name was, he stopped at my site, the research site. And a lot of the narrative was, okay, he was on Instagram, he was posting this last message saying that he wanted to do such and such to the police officers. And then that narrative became, see what Black Lives Matter activists are doing, see what all of these black and brown kids are doing. They're starting race wars and riots. And I remember that particular time when those narratives in social media played a large part in that. Going back to your point about how do we know who's saying what, where does valid information come from, how do you verify, what stories are we mixing up with other narratives. So, Bryn, I want to get your thoughts, too, on this issue, because you seem to have a lot to say about this.
Some people would accuse me of always having a lot to say.
No, that's totally fine. I want to kind of get into more of an in-depth discussion about where certainly the legal ramifications of social media, but also how people are using this platform. And it's not all people that are using it, to Carmen's point. And I kind of want to get into that question. Is social media an elitist type of platform media?
Wow. Where does that stop, though? Mainstream media is elitist. Social media is elitist. What isn't elitist then? I mean, you know, it used to be, oh, no one can afford to print a handbill except for rich white landowners in New York City who wanted to protest against the English government. You know, then it was, oh, well, it's only rich white men that can vote, so that's elitist. Well, then we made it more generally available, and then it was, oh, now it's the media, because it became mainstream media, even in the 1800s, when we went from everybody having handbills to having national or regional newspapers that got distributed, and we were able to do that technologically, and now we have social media. And social media, to me, isn't all that different. I actually usually tend to disagree with people that would, even on a legal perspective. Now, disclaimer, not a lawyer. Child of two lawyers, not at a website that deals a lot with law.
You're a lawyer by default.
Okay, just I want to make that clear before somebody, you know, throws something like a legal textbook at me, because I won't read it. But the question then becomes, you know, if we're going to ask if social media is going to affect a trial, we already ask if media affects a trial. Mm-hmm. So the research that shows the media does affect a jury pool, the research that is definitive that shows that media affects witness pools. Obviously, social media is part of that. I think that it's often a big jump nowadays to really define the two as substantially different. Even when we talk about people coming out with information, people being prosecuted by or persecuted, excuse me, by the police after providing information. Absolutely clear-cut cases of that, and that's terrifying, by the way. I do not obviously think that that's a good thing. What I will say, though, is that, you know, in theory, 25, 30 years ago, when their only outlet was not Instagram or Twitter, was a journalist, somebody who is on the payroll of a newspaper, they would go to that person and they would hand them the same photo. They'd hand them the same eyewitness account, and the journalist would shield them in most cases, not in all cases. We have obviously lots of First Amendment prosecution with the media and what that means, but there was at that point a mechanism that shielded the eyewitness that gave the information to the media rather than the police from it. And nowadays we've broken that. We don't have that, and there's no way to have it. And sometimes for incredible great effect, because we do get the eyewitness account, we can go question someone, we can find out when maybe it was too quick or it was the wrong angle or this, that, and the other. We don't necessarily trust the mainstream media to have reported it or accurately represented what they said, but we used to have that shield. There was that legal protection that protected an individual source from public scrutiny, and now we don't have that anymore. Mm-hmm. So I think that it's interesting. We talk about all these things as if they're really different, and I just don't think that they are. To your real question, though, about elitism, I think the bigger question is not, is social media elitist, but is a narrative or a story or an incident elitist? Is a black person being shot by a cop a story that doesn't get told when it's in Baltimore but does get told when it's in St. Louis? Is a child being abducted a story when she's of a certain race or of a certain economic background and not when she's of another one? Absolutely. Stories and humanity are elitist. Social media does not help that. In really the best way we think it can. It has balanced the scales in a couple of very key examples. But we're always going to have that. As we get used to social media the same way that we got used to newspapers in the 20th century, we're going to have the same problem that what pops to the surface, what gets the attention. It will no longer be editors of the New York Times making that decision. It will be the mass public. But the mass public has proven to be just as fallible in this as editors of the New York Times.
I want to add something to what he's saying I think it's important to bring up Justice or Else. There was the 20th anniversary of the Million Man March that Farrakhan put on. There was a complete media blackout, right? But yet on social media, it was trending. And so again, like, what is elitist and what is the actual story that people want to grab? I think that's a real question that we need to ask ourselves. And I know that in the community, there was this outrage of why, you know, when we're seeing hundreds and thousands of black people gathering, why isn't our voice being amplified through mainstream media?
Right. And this also makes me think, too, about ethics. In journalism, there are ethical standards, and love the attorney on the panel to weigh in on this. Should there be an ethical standard in how we consume, how we share, how we participate in social media spaces?
It's important to note that there's different legal systems that cover this in different ways. The U.S., we have First Amendment. We have much more freedom to say what we want. So the system here is kind of everyone for themselves. But in England, for instance, you have much, much heavier restriction on what can be reported during a trial, what can be said for both regular media and social media. I had some interesting encounters a couple years ago when I was blogging about a group of businessmen in the U.K. who were selling... they were selling fake bomb detectors. So they'd sell them for $10,000 to Egypt, Mexico, Thailand. And they're just plastic with a bit of metal at the end. They didn't do anything. And people were dying because of it. Because they think they have bomb detectors, and they don't. They have a piece of plastic. And I was blogging about it and pointing out how absurd this was and how the British government needed to stop it. And those businessmen would start emailing and writing my blog saying, you can't do this. This is slander. You're not allowed to do it. And then when they got prosecuted eventually, their attorneys start emailing me and saying, take your post down or we'll sue you, it's illegal. I'm like, well, no, I'm actually across the ocean, so it's fine. but if I'd been in the UK, it would have been a real issue. I probably would have taken it down because under their law, that kind of reporting, even from social media or from a blogger, isn't allowed because they think it's contrary to the fairness of the system. There's benefits to both ways, I can see. I think ours is ultimately the better way of handling it. But the UK has decided for itself that allowing citizen journalism is not okay, and it's not what they want. So it's not just the people that will decide. It can be the law. there are ways for a legal system to regulate this, and we might start seeing more of that to a certain degree in the U.S. There's not much they can do, but especially in other jurisdictions. If they don't want citizen journalism to follow cases, they can stop it. Mm-hmm. But back to your question about ethics and reporting, there probably should be. I don't know how you'd enforce that. I don't know who would decide that. I don't know how you begin to approach it.
I'm thinking, too, about ethics of care. You know, when folks are on social media, and I'm always on Twitter, I'm following the news. I have friends who are writers on online media outlets, and some of the folks who do write, when they're writing about stories about Ferguson or Baltimore, they will, for example, here's one example of sort of what I would understand as an ethics of care. They would ask a person if they could use his tweets in the story, even if it's public.
I have seen a few times, just encountering myself, the awkward scenes where someone writes, "My aunt just died in a shooting." And you'll see a reporter tweet back saying, "Can I contact you to ask about this?" Like, no, that's not okay. There should be a clear line against that kind of invasive contact for a victim of a crime as it's happening.
Doesn't that go back to one of the earlier comments about what makes a journalist? I mean, we can talk in this room as people that, you know, I mean, you're even identifying yourself. You're like, "I'm not a journalist. I'm a lawyer that happens to be, you know, doing a blog that or doing a podcast people are following on it." But, you know, it's not a simple answer to say that everyone's a journalist or no one's a journalist or some of it's an activist. And I understand that activist is being thrown at certain people that I would say are journalists to often excuse people cracking down on them or excluding them from interviews and things like that. But on the flip side, I also think that there are activists out there that are often being given some of the same latitude and leeway that journalists are, particularly in war zones. And this is from a global perspective. I did a panel about a year ago now, actually, that was talking about this and saying, you know, well, isn't it bad that journalists are being killed in war zones? And I said, well, obviously, I mean, nobody wants that to be happening. No one wants anyone dying in there. But I said, where is the line at times between an activist on the ground and a journalist? It can no longer be, well, they weren't carrying a gun, so they must have been a journalist. That's not really the appropriate response anymore. There's a lot of shades of gray in there. So on the domestic side, if we're going to talk about an ethics, if we're going to talk about care, if we're going to talk about standards, then we have to talk about what a definition of a journalist is. And as much as I was saying that social media has become basically media as a whole, it is media as a whole done by a whole bunch of people that on Monday they're a journalist, on Tuesday they're a private citizen, and on Wednesday they're an activist, and on Thursday they're a journalist. I don't know how to parse that. I want to give everybody the full protection. I think that anybody is telling me the truth, I want to give the protection to and listen to. But, you know, if they're telling me the truth on Monday and on Tuesday they're saying, well, don't engage with me because I'm a private citizen, I don't – okay. Then I don't know what to do. Now, I'm not bullying people. I just want to make it clear. But, like, you know, if they're coming out and they're saying these things online and then somebody's contacting them for a comment or what they're seeing and then they're saying, oh, no, don't do that, it's a little bit hard. And that line gets grayer and grayer every day.
I do have that happening often when I'm out in the field somewhere. You know, we were marching from New York City to D.C. And we were staying in Baltimore the day that Freddie Gray was announced, pronounced dead. And we had the Baltimore Sun following us because we had rerouted to the precinct. And because the Baltimore Sun was following us, they were able to capture the story of Freddie Gray that then shed light to what was happening. And that went national. But, you know, there's sometimes when you're just in a space and you're taking a photo and you just tweet it and all of a sudden you have somebody reaching out to you saying if they could share it. And oftentimes because we are in those spaces, I don't have a problem with it. Very similar to what you're saying, you know, I'm an activist 24 hours and there's times where I stop and actually want to capture where I am. But I think there's somebody else that needs to tell the story beyond myself.
So that begs the question, though, I'm thinking of the young activists on campus who they are in these public spaces, they are protesting, but at the same time, do they deserve to have safe spaces in public space? I know, I'm quoting Gloria Anzaldúa here, there are no safe spaces, but should we offer these safe spaces for young people coming through and doing this kind of work, or is it an issue, is it a problem? I'm still trying
to... I kind of feel it depends, mm-hmm. You know. I know that for us in Baltimore, the media came out and they began to agitate the community and us that were marching. And at a certain point, we had to withdraw from the scene, right? We had to protect those that were marching with us. There were 16-year-olds with us. There was about 100 of us. I think it kind of depends on the situation. If people want privacy, I mean, I'm not speaking on behalf of every activist, but when I am able to capture something and I'm being contacted, it's my response. You know, it's the way in which I'm going to respond, whether yes or no. And I think there should be, I don't know if it's privacy, but I think it's more respect in those circumstances. But, you know, and it's all circumstantial. Yeah. I can't say, you know, what happened in, we were also passing through Maryland and we were getting called out by the KKK there, you know, and we wish media was there, right? So it kind of, it depends on where you are and what space you're in. And certainly we don't want to go into communities and activate violence. So I think it is circumstantial.
Mm-hmm. Jackie, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this too, given the work that you do with your organization.
Yeah, I mean, the situation in Missouri, I think, is very much a gray area for me. I definitely support the notion of a safe space, and I think that people should have that, but I think it's hard when it isn't a public space, and there is the journalistic right, you know, the First Amendment right to report on that stuff. You know, the situation like in Missouri with the media and kind of all the media coverage can distract from the real issue, which my understanding is that was one of the things that activists were trying to prevent. And I think that sometimes we let these conversations about what we're seeing in the media distract from what's actually happening or what the issue at hand is. And I think it's, again, an issue with video and photos and this police harassment. And there, now we hear people saying, oh, well, if there's no video, it didn't happen. Or, you know, the Walter Scott case, like, what if there was no video? That might have never gone noticed. And so I think, well, I think it's really important that those videos are coming out and being utilized in good and effective ways. I think that this reliance on media and social media and citizen reporting can make us, can be a little bit of a distraction from the fact that sometimes that media isn't even used in the justice system. And the justice system here in this country is very broken. And so while we're talking about, oh, well, they need to enter the video into the court case, we're not talking about, well, that might not ever happen because, or we'll never find out because the court case is sealed off and we'll never even know, like in the Eric Garner case, when there was a video that was very clear what happened and still we had a non-indictment, so.
Yeah.
I got to ask some questions in response to all of these. Protesters having safe space and being able to express their views is obviously something that, like, conceptually everyone would get behind. I like the quote that you started with, there is no such thing as a safe space. I also think that protesters are getting better at controlling the narrative, and that's good from a communications point of view, but not necessarily more genuine than it used to be. Protest leaders now understand that video of even one of their members throwing a rock through a window steals the narrative and steals the thunder. It turns the Seattle WTO protests of the late 90s from a protest about legitimate concerns about trade into rowdy 20-year-olds taking over Starbucks. And that's what we remember. We remember the riot that broke out, not the protest. And no one really cares about the WTO in the same way anymore because we've kind of gotten over it or whatever. But if a protester can say, back up, please give me space, can a police officer say the same? If a protester can say, back up, give me space, can the white woman who was caught on video saying incredibly awful, awful things to the protesters, can she also say, back up, do not use that video? That video, I believe, got that woman fired, or at least it was under consideration.
Yeah, she's gone.
So, I mean, from a personal perspective, what she said was horrible. And I don't like to think of a person that's leading young minds having that kind of point of view. But if a protester can say that in Missouri, why can't she? And if we start on one, why not the other? And it can't always default to, well, we pick the people we think need to be protected in this situation, but the other people don't need to be protected. I think that you had a great point, Carmen. Like, you know, we wanted our space in that situation because we didn't want to activate violence. I absolutely agree with that. And I think it's a great thing about how you want to pull back and you want to keep groups somewhat separate in those situations. You want to put some buffer zones in there. You want to create a safe space between two opposing groups that may antagonize each other because tensions are running high. But you also wanted, you know, the coverage of like the KKK calling you out. And I would say I would also want that coverage. You know, I'd want people to see that this antagonism is going on. And in that sense, frankly, I probably want to see that the antagonism is going on from a professor or a member of staff at a university yelling at students that have a different point of view. But I think it's got to be one way or the other. Either that we can be there with cameras, and actually I don't think the woman that I'm thinking of was caught by a journalist. I think she was caught by a cell phone.
Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, that was even beyond the spectrum of, well, can journalists be there, but who has the right to share video of another person's point of view? And so I think it's very difficult. It's always shades of gray, but it's specifically very difficult in this day and age when you can say on one side we should be able to control the narrative and step back, and on the other we can say, well, if it serves my purposes, man, it's truth. It's truth to power. It's truth to bigotry. And I'd rather err on the side of truth to bigotry if I have to err on one of the sides.
Susan.
Oh, I fully agree. You can't have sometimes a safe space when it's not rule. It should be always open. But at the same time, from an ethics perspective, you can't have the media there antagonizing everyone else. And they have an interest in doing so. They get better coverage if they cause tensions, if they cause people to get pissed off and start making scenes. To the extent that's happening, there should be stronger ethical restrictions on that. But in terms of just filming and not turning part of the story themselves, I don't think you can restrict that.
Shifting a little bit, moving into the sort of economic capitalism question, how does the eventual move toward monetization of platforms like Facebook and the sponsored ad problematize our sharing of information, especially when it comes to organizations like Witness, when we're talking about activism? Does that problematize the campaigns and the movements, or does it help monetizing?
Can I ask, when you say monetizing, do you mean charging people to put ads in people's Facebook, or do you mean monetizing by people making money off of putting up videos?
Monetizing in terms of, like, for example, the sponsored ads.
Okay. So, like, sponsored posts. Right?
Yeah.
There's different things. Because one is, like, you know, you can have an organization monetize by having really great advocacy ads that, you know, has a person running an ad in the first 15 seconds on YouTube. And I think there's a lot. I mean, that's a different set of concerns.
I will say that Race Forward, we do have ads on Facebook. I am trying to get at, though, does it dilute messages, though? I mean, we're talking about grassrootsy kind of stuff, and I have my own opinion about it, but I like to hear, does the monetization of our movements dilute the message? Does the us become them? Does that line, or does it matter?
I'm not an expert on any of this stuff, but personally, I feel like, yes, it does a little bit, but at the same time, and it drives me crazy when I click on a video to watch, you know, a report about Syrian migrants, and first I have to watch a shampoo commercial.
Right.
It's like, this
right.
seems really messed up.
Right.
But we're always kind of in this, walking this tense line of, you know, do we go somewhere that's new and stands more with our ideas and our values, or do we go where the people are if we're trying to get our message out? And, you know, it just really depends on what your objectives are. If you're trying to get your message out to a lot of people, then oftentimes it is more effective to use those big platforms like Facebook and YouTube. But if you're trying to organize something like a protest, or that's more, a smaller protest or a smaller event, or trying to discuss campaign strategy, I think that it does make more sense then to use more private spaces or newer, more innovative platforms that enable you to have conversations that are perhaps encrypted or private, not being monitored by these big companies and not subject to monetization.
And thank you for bringing that up, because I I've gone through that before, looking at Facebook, looking at my feed. I've actually had to stop the videos from playing because some of it was just some of the images were out of control. But yeah, having these commercials pop up during while you're consuming such, I'll say traumatic stuff.
Yeah.
And it is problematic. Carmen, I'm wondering what you're thinking about sort of monetization in terms of how we're promulgating our ideas in these spaces.
So I know that there's the boost, right?
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
Boost your yes. page yep. Factor. And I think, you know, for us as a grassroots initiative, you know, there's times in which we need to boost our page because we need to certainly attract a certain audience, but we don't do that very often. And I think, you know, Facebook at this moment is free. And in order for it to be free, there needs to be ads. It needs to be paid somehow. And I think even though it's annoying, all those different ads, I will say I'm always trying to do the skip right on the YouTube video. It's kind of like, right, within 3 seconds you could skip or something. I just, at this moment, you know, I don't really have time to pay attention to it. Unfortunately, we're constantly on the ground. We're constantly really trying to amplify the work through every type of social media means, Instagram, Periscope, whatever it may be. And I think it is annoying the way in which Facebook has really evolved. And to your point earlier, you were talking about, you know, there was this check-in factor, right? Of making sure that people in Paris were able to check in and say, hey, I'm alive. But really, again, it's really about accessibility, yeah. right? And, because I know that's not happening in other countries, and that's certainly not happening in a community where there, is a lot of violence, right? Like, why aren't we having that happen in Chicago when we've heard that there's 150 shootings on a weekend? So again, it's access for me. It's like, who's actually promoting their brand on Facebook, on YouTube? And I know for us smaller organizations with a large impact, you know, it's kind of like, all right, let's just keep it moving. You mm-hmm. know, it's unfortunate. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But we have to use those means in order to get our work out. And because although we do the marches, right, we march, we do the protest, a lot of the people that we could get into our trainings are on social media. You know, it's really hard to canvas a whole community, but our outreach strategy and a large part of our outreach strategy is doing social media outreach.
Mm-hmm. I remember Alicia Garza, listening to her, who's one of the co-founders of Black Lives Matter. She was saying the same exact thing, using social media as an organizing tool, but also being very aware of how social media is monitored, surveyed, especially FBI and things like that. You have to be very careful in how you use these platforms. I also want to talk to you about sort of the culture, the social media culture, and there's celebrity culture there. And with Serial and Undisclosed, part of the reason why the case of Adnan Syed was re-entered the public consciousness was because of certainly the podcast create a sense of true drama, true crime drama. For better or worse, they each crafted compelling characters out of real people. I'm wondering, what are your thoughts about attracting the public's attention and keeping it with or without the benefit of, say, for instance, the celebrity culture? I remember when it came out, there were so many people talking about it and a lot of celebrities were talking about it. But what if you don't have that bullhorn? How do we keep those stories out there?
Social media has been big, obviously, and Adnan Syed's case. But at the same time, it's really only a small fraction of our listeners that are on social media. I mean, they're the ones you see and interact with, so the ones you know better. But if you look at the numbers, they really are just a tiny, tiny percentage of everyone who is listening to our show. So I'm not sure it's really as vital as we might like to think it is. And it does help. It does get the name out there. It might have a new listener never heard of you, learn of you. But at the same time, I don't think it's fair to say it's driven by social media.
Does celebrity culture drive social media?
Possibly. I'm actually like not big on social media. I've never tweeted really until this, and I still forget most of the time to log in.
I will
the irony.
Add to that.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
A lot of the work that we do at Justice League, the founder of our organization is Harry Belafonte, and Harry Belafonte was involved in the civil rights movement with Dr. King, and he was able to use his platform to amplify civil rights and actually bring together his peers. But, you know, and we do the same thing. We use artists to come into the detention center with us. We use celebrity to amplify the work that we're doing because we are sometimes like this on the ground thinking about, okay, what's our next move? What are we going to do? Where's the strategy? And we may not be speaking the same language that other folks are speaking. So we use a lot of hip-hop artists to talk to the community that we don't have access to. There's a young man by the name of Maison, Immortal Technique, Russell Simmons. These are individuals that open the door for us when we don't have access. And so Mr. Belafonte always talks about, and it's a quote from Paul Robeson, artists are the gatekeepers to truth. They are civilization's radical voice. And that's actually debatable, right? So we could have a debate about that as well. But I think for us, they've really been able to take us to a different level in regards to just the work that we're doing. We have a lot of policy priorities. They come out to our press conferences. They support us. They have concerts that will also talk about police brutality. I know Usher's doing a new thing where they're working with the families of police. Victims of police brutality as well. So I think, you know, for us and Justice League and, you know, other people have a different strategy and a different opinion. But for us, they're really able to amplify our work. And I think we're really grateful for their presence. But they allow us to be the activists and we allow them to mm-hmm. be the artists.
That's
and
important.
I know that currently there's this like intersection of artivist, which mm-hmm. is great. Mm-hmm. But I think just for us specifically, you know, it's not about giving them talking points and you being a talking head. It's like, you really need to be invested in our community. We need you to come out beyond, you know, you showing up to a press conference. Come into the detention center. Come to a rally. Come into our office and let's build these relationships.
Mm-hmm. And I guess it's part of it. You only really see your effect through social media. Mm-hmm. And obviously your goal is to affect more than social media. But that's harder to monitor because you don't know who you're engaging with secondhand. All you see is the engagements you have online. So you'd hope that your effect is going bigger, and I'm sure it is, but I don't know how do you guys measure that?
Well, when you get a call from the governor and he's telling you he wants to meet with you because he has heard that you're making a lot of noise in his city, and his state, I think that's I can't give you the matrix on the measure, right? But I can
say, see it.
But we can see it. Also, we had what was called an economic shutdown where we took some people into the Apple store and into Macy's, and we did a die-in kind of during the winter months. And, you know, Russell Simmons called us up because he got a call from somebody in Macy's saying, what are these kids doing? What do they want? You know, you tell us now because we don't want them to flood Macy's ever again. So, you know, I think we don't necessarily have we don't have the numbers of impact, but we definitely do get some of the cause and how, you know, some of these folks who have access are able to get us into certain doors.
Yeah. No, I think Witness is also in a similar position because our co-founder was a musician and activist, Peter Gabriel. Mm. And so it definitely helps to have that exposure and have a big name associated with your organization. But I think it's really important that when you're working with celebrities, you obviously have a strong strategy for the campaign, but you're also treating that celebrity like a partner in the campaign and not just a figure on a pedestal who's broadcasting this message, because then it just seems very disingenuine. And to the question of impact, I think we've seen some cases, like we had a campaign a couple years ago in Mexico around disappearance of women and violence against women, and we worked with Gael Garcia Bernal and Diego Luna, two well-known actors there, directors, to speak to the politicians and to really start moving policy forward. And when we started seeing some policy changes around what was happening in Juarez, especially, then you know it's more than just a social media impact. And of course, the issue is still happening, so you can't expect that, you know, someone famous is going to go up there and solve everything. But I think that that exposure and just having someone who has an audience that is much bigger than we alone could ever garner is can be really helpful.
And it seems like to a certain degree, having a celebrity involved is good for getting the mainstream media involved. They may not cover your cause, but if you've got a big name A-lister beside you, they'll come cover that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Global Citizen, you know, we're known probably best in many places for the Global Citizen Festival. You know, this year we had Beyonce and Pearl Jam and Ed Sheeran and Coldplay.
Oh, that was you guys.
Yeah.
Oh, I went to that.
Yeah, see, there you go. Man,
I did. It was great. I got my ticket.
Did you have a good time?
I had a great time. Yeah.
And you took
very
action
much.
To get your ticket, right?
Yes, I did.
See, we incentivize people getting involved often through celebrity. And that's one of the parts of our models that works, that celebrity can be an incentive. You give people a reward, whatever that reward is, and you can get them involved. And the goal is to bring people in the door for a reason that maybe catches them off guard. Maybe we take somebody who's like, man, I love Ed Sheeran. We want to talk to you about extreme poverty. What? You know, and you're like, okay, like, let's like, you know. But then you hope that through the process, and our process is one we gate the ability to be eligible to win a free ticket by having to get involved and having to take political action to end extreme poverty. Poverty. And so that's, you know, we do get some throughput. We get some people that come in and just click, 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 click. Eh, I have to do like write an email. Oh, I have to make a phone call. Oh, okay. Their goal is still the concert. But the goal is that over this course of these journeys that people then internalize at least a little bit of the message. And that's a really powerful one. The other aspect of it is, though, that I think that you've heard it kind of a refrain from my colleagues here, like the governor calling, politicians calling, earned media. The question was, does celebrity culture drive social media? I'd say no. I think that people use social media to connect with their friends. Yes, people follow Taylor Swift. Yes, people follow Beyonce. But at the end of the day, they're using Snapchat because they can talk to their friends, not so they can talk to Beyonce, though that'd be fun too. So social media is still driven by your community. All it does is magnify what we do in our communities, which is be obsessed with celebrities. And when people are obsessed with celebrities, they listen to celebrities. So when celebrities are engaged with your movement, people find a reason to engage with your movement. The mistake I often see is that people just say, oh, if we slap a celebrity's name on top of this, people will care. No, not so much. We find real backlash, actually, with our Global Citizens. And if we just sort of do something and it's a little bit like, oh, celebrity name, and we don't necessarily show why that celebrity is connected, it does not perform well, whether it's on social media in any other way. We have to show the partnership. We have to show the engagement. As sort of a crowning achievement of the festival period, Stephen Colbert, who is one of our hosts, who's a celebrity with a great following, he didn't just say, oh, I'm hosting and yay, see you later. He did a specific campaign. One of our through-line campaigns of the entire campaigning period was about getting Norway to increase its education commitment to global education. And after we did a series of tweets and emails and some, you know, behind-the-scenes campaigning, Stephen Colbert made a video that he quote-unquote launched a Twitter invasion of Norway. And it was hilarious. And people and earned media would just jumped all over this. And we sent something like 40,000 tweets like in the next little bit, like on this thing. And it was one of the turning points with the Prime Minister of Norway, because not only now was she incentivized, not only was there a good campaign, not only was there good politics behind it, but the media is behind it. And she saw an opportunity to capitalize as well. And she made a hilarious response video to him. And this is a woman that you don't necessarily immediately assume has a sense of humor, but she was hilarious. You know, and that's where you start sort of melding that. So I think that celebrity doesn't drive social media, but for the smart and able and lucky enough campaigner that can have the right celebrity partnership, it is a powerful tool to drive attention. It's a powerful tool to open doors, and it's a powerful tool to leverage for change.
And I will have to agree. I know we didn't receive like 100,000 followers after we had all these celebrities participate, but I will say there is like some backfiring that happens. We had what was called the royal shutdown, where the royal family was in town, and we wanted to kind of show them, hey, well, you know, you came to the pageantry of New York, and that's beautiful, but, you know, there was somebody who just got killed. And so we had arranged, we made a phone call to a friend who was connected to Jay-Z, and we produced I Can't Breathe t-shirts in a matter of like 5 hours, printed them, produced them in, on a couch at 3 a.m. And we delivered them to the Barclays Center while there was going to be a game. So as we were protesting outside, and Jay-Z helped facilitate these t-shirts being distributed to the net players, he sends a text message to us, right? There's a there was a text message that was sent to me, and it was Jay-Z with the players, and Jay-Z didn't have the t-shirt, but all the players did. And so everybody went in on Jay-Z, and they're like, why didn't he have a t-shirt on? And so there was this whole thing where he was trying to facilitate good, and it actually backfired on him. And so, you know, you have to really be strategic, and you know, you just can't use people. It's for us, it was just kind of like, wait, but we didn't make one for him. It was for the players, you know, like, and so having to take ownership again of your own story, because that got out into mainstream media and everybody was talking about Jay-Z, how much Jay-Z didn't care about the protest movement to even wear a shirt.
Yes. So I remember that vividly, but I also, that was a wonderful campaign, because I remember the following week, I went to Cleveland, my hometown, wearing an I Can't Breathe t-shirt, mm-hmm. because I was so inspired by that initiative, which brings me to my last question before we open it up to audiences. What are some inspiring campaigns that you're working on or that you have your eye on that you want to give a shout out to? We want to know what you're doing right now and what you see other folks doing that are using media in these innovative ways to promote your work.
One initiative I'm a big fan of and that I'm really impressed by is when we featured an episode on Disclosed. Kendra Hovey works with a group that is basically a outreach to prisoners, and she's in Ohio. And what they're doing is pretty amazing in its own way. The prison actually works with TEDx, and they had TEDx talks to the prison. And they're more open to social media and allowing the prisoners to have a way to connect with the outside world, maybe not personally, but like their message can get out there. People can see them as the humans they are, which is a rarity in prisons. But at the same time, there's kind of a tension there, because obviously if you listen to our episode, you know that we couldn't get approval for half the audio for complicated reasons that were frustrating to deal with. And as amazing as the prison was, the system was, and I'm grateful to them for working with us. Even there was stumbling blocks that you wouldn't expect. But these groups, and there's more out there than just Ohio, are doing really great work, and they're showing the power of social media, because prisoners don't have access to it, and that's why it's why abuses can happen more so than elsewhere, because there's no one there to capture it in video and tweet it out. So it can go uncommented on, unseen. And by having these ways for prisoners to connect with the real world, that breaks the barrier down a bit.
Thank you.
We have several initiatives that are going to be launching. We have a leadership academy that we're going to launch in the beginning of the year next year, as well as we have a conference in Detroit called Growing Up Lockdown. That's going to be next September. But one of the major campaigns that we're working on right now is called Chokehold on the City. It's going to be the 1 year of the non-indictment of Officer Daniel Pantaleo, who was responsible for the death of Eric Garner. We are in the middle of providing direct action trainings, one on November 24th and one on December 1st. You could go to our website to get more information, which is gatheringforjustice.org. But we're really wanting people to come out to the streets, whether you can come out to the streets or you could support via social media. We really want to make sure that one of our demands is met. We have a set of 10 demands, and firing him is actually number one.
Great.
There's a lot out there. I think one thing that Witness is just starting to work on that I'm really excited about is more of a focus on police abuse here in the United States and kind of how we're capturing bad policing on video. And so we're just starting to work with some cop watch groups that are very grassroots and in the communities that are most targeted by police brutality, and helping people feel more empowered to pick up a camera and document something, and also to act as kind of deterrence. You know, I think there are some times when people know that they're being watched, they behave a little bit differently. And I think it's a good way not only to capture abuses, but also a way to kind of provide a counter narrative and to stand up and represent locally. So I'm excited about that. I also just want to give a shout out to the Greenpeace kayaktivist movement that happened a couple months ago that I think was really brilliant. So that was inspiring.
So I'm always impressed by other activists. A lot of those are incredibly powerful and I think very tangible for an American audience. Global Citizens campaigns are a bit different. We often talk about activating governments to provide better funding for things like the Global Partnership for Education, for things like health infrastructures and rebuilding West Africa after the Ebola crisis and things like that. So our grassroots is often the challenge is about convincing people that one very tangible way to get involved in a community is to do the types of things that my colleagues are doing. And I would tell every global citizen out there to absolutely get involved in all of those. The other aspect is taking somebody in Des Moines, Iowa, and convincing them that they can do something that helps somebody in Madagascar or helps somebody in Indonesia or helps get a toilet and the cultural changes it takes to get a community to use a toilet in Southeast Asia or in India and things like that. So a lot of our campaigns in 2016 are going to start with that concept, which is sort of an underlying, we always sort of pivot back to that. We take our big policy wins out of the Global Citizen Festival. And often when we go to the new year, we're really going to talk about the global goals. So the global goals are 17 goals that were signed on by all the member states of the United Nations to guide international development for the next 15 years. Their predecessor was the Millennium Development Goals, which even the Bush administration, and yes, I did say even the Bush administration embraced with many of their activities in 2004 to 2007 with particularly a lot of the Project Africa stuff. But the global goals have outlined 17 very specific steps that need to be taken to improving the world. And they do ladder up to the idea of ending extreme poverty by 2030, which is one of those goals that you're like, that's insane. But the reality is, and the challenge that we have is trying to convince people that it is real. The world in the last 20 years has reduced extreme poverty by over half. For the first time ever, 2015 saw the share of global humanity that lives in extreme poverty fall under 10%. Our challenge is to convince people that these things are possible. And then tell them, yes, it's possible, and yes, your actions can make your governments make this a reality. And so a lot of what we're going to be spending the New Year's on is really focusing on the global goals. Our goal in 2015 was to make them famous. Our goal in the early part of 2016 is to then take them from being famous to make them a national resolution for leaders, making them tangible, making governments make hard commitments to not just say, yeah, they look pretty on paper, but actually I'm going to take some concrete steps to put the funding, put the programming in line, and put the steps in line to actually start making a real change for people on the ground.
Great. Thank you. Thank you all. I'd like to open it up to some questions from the audience. If anyone has any, should I hand the mic to you?
I thought I could put the mic up and people could walk down here.
I'll start. I better not be the only one.
And also, this is a total like fanboy question, so and it's aimed at Susan, so so we'll get this over with, and then you guys can ask the more important questions. So you guys have a next season coming up. Undisclosed has a season coming up, 2016, in which the focus will not be the case of Adnan Syed. Do you have an idea of what your next case is going to be? Will you reveal it now before us all, or will you continue to keep us in suspense?
We're getting very close. We got a lot of submissions, and it was kind of emotionally overwhelming at times because there was a lot of people with sad stories and about their relatives, and they're reaching out to me. And most of them, there's no way I could help them. The case, for whatever reason, wasn't something we could do anything about. Maybe involved DNA or just nothing that the podcast could cover. But just seeing that and seeing them reach out, sort of like a Hail Mary, was overwhelming at times. And it shows how much of a need there is for this kind of work and for IP's work and for more groups that focus on DNA and more on just locating these cases, looking at them again, and questioning the prosecutors and the detectives involved in them. That being said, we've had a few that we're looking at. Whatever case we choose, it's going to be really interesting, I think. There's a lot of sad stories out there, but it'll also be pretty familiar too, in a way. At first, I started thinking like, "Wow, this case is really like a nonce. It's so similar. It's got timelines that don't work. It's got routes that don't add up. It's got cell phones and the same forensic issues." And then eventually, I started realizing that no, these issues actually just happen a lot. It's not that like a nonce case. It's that these same problems are occurring again and again and again. So yeah, there'll be some similar themes, but I think soon we'll have a case.
I'm curious for suggestions or thoughts on how social media might be utilized to sort of generate and create more productive conversation. So on all of my social media the last 2 days, I've been screaming past other people by sharing and liking the heck out of, anything I could find around the Syrian refugee crisis. And I'm pretty sure people are, sharing and liking and right back at me. We're talking past, we're just kind of screaming past each other. Social media is tremendously helpful to me right now in helping me be more aware or have more data, more facts around issues I already have a tendency to care about, right? But I don't know how productive it is in helping people have conversations. I mean, I know with Undisclosed, you guys have people who are not open to hearing what you have to say but want to engage with you in a really negative way. I'm sure some people are hopeless, but what are ways, in which we might be able to have more productive conversations with people who think at least somewhat differently than we do?
I know for us, there's moments where we have town hall Twitter town halls. Have you heard of those? So you can actually probably reach out to organizations and develop a list of questions. And you'll reach out to folks and say, on this day at 2 p.m., we're going to have a Twitter town hall on this conversation. Use this hashtag. And that allows for engagement from other communities outside. And so a lot of the times that when we do our Twitter town halls, it's really based on juvenile justice, criminal justice reform. So we use something that's very similar. So, if you look at what's trending, maybe you kind of take that and add it to as a hashtag to the conversation that you want to have. And then just kind of because people will look at that. I'm not sure if that makes sense, but we could talk more about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, I also am not a huge social media user. I do use Twitter for work a lot. But I think that sometimes we're quick to underestimate the value of talking in person. I think social media can be a great way to get people together and you can ask people who maybe couldn't be at an event in person to submit their questions in advance or participate remotely that way. But I think that it's set up now so that we're kind of subject to all these algorithms that are giving us what we want to see, what we already think, what we already believe, and it's hard to get outside of that. So I think maybe using it as a way to take a step outside of social media can be effective too.
I'd also suggest using your base as much as possible, even if it's a small base. The best person to convince a person is a friend, and the best way to convince someone that's a skeptic is to have a friend share something that you're saying. I often have this debate with some of our leadership that wants us to expand all the time. They're like, tell me, Brandon, how we can talk to the new people. How can we speak to the people that don't follow us and get them to follow us? And I say, well, let me explain to you how social media works. If they're a follower, then I can speak to them. And if they're not, a little hard for me unless it's a sponsored post, which gets us back into that question. Which, by the way, I'm actually okay with sponsored posts, just as an aside. But if you can speak to your base, and speak to them in a way that you can try to look at their habits, particularly when you have anything over a smaller group. What makes them share to their networks? Start maximizing that. Start maximizing the type of communications that empower them to feel like they're smart, to feel like they're positive, A lot of algorithms now, or a lot of studies of Facebook, are showing that people share to look smart, for lack of a kinder way to put that. They don't necessarily want to share because it's a cat gif, though they do that. They want to look like they're good at curating. So if it's funny, they want to look like they have a sense of humor. If it's smart, they want to look like they read it, even if all they did was like it and share it. so we all want to be the best curators of social media ever. So find a way to utilize that desire of your base and get them to share to your networks. That's step one. Step two, I mean, this is where you get into the, do you feed the trolls or do you not? I would err on the not. I would remind people that as much as social media has become anonymity keeps us more virulently angry, it is also the worst form of public speaking that anyone has ever gone through. And if we can all agree that public speaking is scarier than death for many people, then somebody seeing their comment get attacked, even if you don't think you're attacking it, but get countered by someone else in a very seemingly permanent, though we all know very impermanent way, oh my God, they're not going to want to engage with you. So I think that finding ways to, you know, if they're in a chain on Facebook, comment on other people around them, because they're still going to be watching, like other people around them, be positive. That'll help you.
Yeah. And one thing I've enjoyed about Undisclosed is that it's not so much trying to expand our listenership, but using our existing listenership to expand them to new issues. Because a lot are listening because they like the case, they're interested in Nunsayed, and suddenly we can make them interested in like bail issues. I'm sure otherwise they never would have cared or known about it. But because they care about this case and the surrounding issues, it's a way and say, hey, look, here's what else is going on. Here's a problem you might not have been aware of, but it's also part of the justice system and something needs to be fixed and it's worth your attention.
And that works both ways, because as soon as you get that other issue involved, there's a whole group of people out there that like that other issue, and all of a sudden they see that you're involved, and ooh, that seems good. That's another great way to, like, expanding your base will get them to activate people that didn't realize that you were somebody that they wanted to be listening to.
So I have two questions. You prefer that I ask both at the same time, or should I ask them separately? Okay. So first one is for Susan specifically. So I read somewhere that people reported that Adnan's family, for example, they tried to talk to him about serial and the effect that it was having on social media. And he was incarcerated before social media really became what it is right now. So I was wondering if you could speak a little bit to that and talk about how you think that might have had an effect on his case earlier if we had the outlets that we're having now and the attention that his case is having now. And my other question is for the other panelists. So I think what I'm getting from all of what you're saying is that it's not just the media that needs to be responsible about what's going on out there. It's also the consumers and how we react. And I was wondering if you could give some general guidelines that you think are good and maybe some more targeted ones that are specific to your issues of how we can responsibly consume and advocate for certain issues when there's a constant stream of information and we don't always fact check, and also how to engage without being a slacktivist, so to speak.
So, to a certain extent, Adnan's case isn't about the social media, and that those problems in his case were always there. They always could have been found. It could have been sooner. It didn't have to wait 16 years. But lack of resources, lack of attention. Without that, what needed to come together never did. Like I said earlier, I think probably the biggest part of the serial effect is getting that information in the first place. Witnesses come forward. Witnesses now know things they didn't before. No one really knew Jay was involved in this case. The people who were like his best friends, people in school, Hay's friends, I didn't know Jay had actually been the one to be the accomplice. Jay and Jen's good friends had no idea. So just getting the facts of the case out there has been transformative. But at the same time, there are cases like Anon's that have no attention. They just have someone who was able to find these problems and bring them forward, and they were able to get relief.
I will say this only because Global Citizen, we're not at the forefront of most breaking news. We were pretty actively involved with the Paris attacks because of the global and the tolerance aspects of it. But I'll actually go back to my previous job, and I used to work in China as a journalist. And if you think that the United States or European media is out of control, you should see social media in China. It is the wild, wild west of chaos. And so I used to handle this question a lot because they just things got out of hand so much faster, partly because there weren't legitimate news sources that were free and fair. So often the option was, do I believe state-run media or do I believe the internet? And there wasn't even a middle ground. There wasn't a legitimate organization like the ones I'm sitting here with that are like, oh, let me tell you the real story in some responsible manner. So, I mean, I would say, like, for me, the checklist is always, first of all, breathe. Breathe, like count to 10 before you like hit tweet, before you respond, like whatever it is. Like, I understand we're all excited, but like it's an instantaneous world that we can be a little less instantaneous. So breathe, be patient. Look as soon as you can for an intersection between mainstream media and what's going on social media. That's one of my rules. That doesn't always mean that I get the truth right away. That sometimes means I realize that mainstream media was absolutely getting it wrong. But often if I'm patient enough to wait for that intersection on a big enough story, there's going to be start to see some pretty obvious, like, well, there's either disconnect or there's obvious bias going on or something. And so I can start seeing at least some element there. That all requires you to wait more than 10 minutes to respond to an issue. So this gets to my last question, which is possibly the most important. Are you helping? I mean, so many people want to be involved and so many people want to like, oh, this is going on. I have to share my outrage. Are you helping? Like, is what you're doing going to help you? Like, if your friends are also going to be outraged, are you helping by telling them right away? Probably not, to be honest. I mean, I hate to say that, but like that immediate spur of the moment chaos, are you helping? No. Social media was being used in the Paris attacks to guide people to safe places. The noise that was being generated by people screaming on social media that had nothing to do with Paris, frankly, we're not helping people get to safety. And that's a hard truth, and it's sort of opposite to what people use social media for, but are you helping? That's where I'd look at people like I'm sitting with, people that are experts. Look at the campaigners. Where I go to that intersection of mainstream and social media. Campaigners can help you over time. They're not necessarily going to be the people that'll be at your door the night of the event, but they're going to tell you in the next couple of days what's a beneficial way to respond. My organization, we often talk about, we want to make sure we spoke to the Prime Minister of Norway prior to Stephen Colbert doing that video, because if we didn't, she could react very badly to that situation. She'd feel under attack. And if you want to get the governor on board, I would say that some of my colleagues have more experience with this, but it's probably better to try to get them on board in some way, shape, or form that they can look like they're the good person in the situation, not that they were hung out to dry and dragged through the mud to get them to do something. Now, sometimes you got to drag them through the mud to get them to do something. I'm not saying that's not right, but let someone with some experience make some of those strategic calls and give them the time and the space to use the uproar to something beneficial. So goes back to breathe and are you helping?
And your question around slacktivism, I did a panel at Chicago Ideas around slacktivism. And I think what's really important to understand is that you, if you want to get engaged, follow the organizations that you actually want to kind of learn more about. We've had several people who have left either their jobs or left their. There's a young woman who found us on Twitter. She left Seattle and she moved all the way to New York City to kind of help us on this 3-day conference. And so I think just kind of like see if the message is consistent, see if, you know, organizations actually have a track record, and get involved beyond just clicking like and sharing. I think there's different ways in which you could get involved in different organizations. And certainly I know there's four of us here, so.
Mm-hmm. And I'll speak to this quickly on the kind of content creator side, especially for people, activists or eyewitnesses who are actually documenting abuses. Witness has a number of resources online at library.witness.org that are aimed to help people create better, more safe, effective media. And that goes from everything to making your media easier to verify by doing things like filming a street sign or a landmark so that it's easier to locate and confirm that that was shot in that place and at that time. And then we also have an ethical guidelines checklist for people to think about what they're doing before they share media. And I think one of the key things is stop and think about it before you do anything. And same with an eyewitness video, we're really encouraging people just pause. Like, yes, you've captured something vitally important, but it might be in the best interest of the person who's affected and yourself to hold off for a little bit or to work with a legal expert or the media before sharing that. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.